You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections, and I, being the second Wednesday of the month, between 1 and 2, we have our legal people in from Hutchison Legal. We have Con and Shimran. Welcome to the two of you.
G'day, Alan. Good to be here.
Good day, Alan.
Very good. The first thing was, I remember the question, where a guy had demolished a house, which is how you've got something else confused, which has nothing to do with it. He bought this block of land, and how it happened has got nothing to do with it. When he, after he demolished it, he put a builder's fence up, but instead of putting it up right at the footpath, he put it about 20 feet in or something like that. He goes down one day to see what the grass is like, and he finds two dump cars there. He goes and asks all the neighbours and said, do you own these cars? And they said, no. So they've just appeared. There is a couple of things. First of all, he rings the police and they say, well, we've checked out, it's not stolen, we don't care, it's nothing to do with us. So he calls the council, and the council said, well, no, it's on private property, we're not going to move it. So there is an obvious thing he could do, is pay somebody to tow him out in the street and then ring the council and say that this cars have been dumped. But first of all, he doesn't want to go to the expense. Secondly, or the other thing he could do is ring up one of these cash for cars, and they come along and they offer him a couple $100. He takes the money and the cars are gone. Some guy comes back a couple of months later and says, hey, where's my cars? And he says, oh, I sold them for $200. And the bloke says, no, they're worth $2,000. So he doesn't want to put himself in any sort of trouble. How does he get rid of these two cars?
Right, so abandoned vehicles. You're right in saying it depends where they are. So often on the street, council will eventually come along and put a sticker on there for a certain amount of time to give notice to the owner, who might come back and check on it from time to time. And that's then after a certain amount of time, they're allowed to tow it away. The council, and it's on the street, correct. Unfortunately for private property owners, they have to act like council, but they've got the added difficulty of the question becomes, do you know whose cars they are or not? So if you've got no idea, you do have to spend money on trying to find out.
So there's nothing you can find out on Vic Roads.
Well, just keep in mind, some people, often people get confused. Vic Roads Register is not the register of owners of vehicles.
Right.
It's the register of the operator of a vehicle. Yeah. So I could go buy a car but register it in my son's name.
Yep.
Who's the owner of the car? And it's not my son, but if you search Vic Roads, you'll come up with my son's name. So so that's not always the... But that's where you would start. That's where the police would start in trying to find the owner.
Well, as you say, we're not interested because they're old cars.
Yes. So they're abandoned and dumped there.
Yep.
Now, unfortunately, you do have to make the effort to try and find the owner, or you have to do what the council does. You have to stick a formal notice on the vehicle that has to be there for a certain amount of time. It's something like that. Like I said, it's very similar to process to what the council would do on the street. You have to do on your private land.
Right.
So you have to put the notice there and wait a certain amount of time before you could then tow it.
Right.
Now, the council might not want me to say it, but you could just tow it to the street.
Well, that's what
and I'm let saying. Council take care of it after that. And then
it's still got a cost of getting them out on the street.
Yeah, well, look, you can't sue anyone until you know who they are, who the owner is.
Yep.
And you'd have to spend money to find out who the owner is.
Yep.
So you have to make your choice. Do you want to really know who the owner is to go sue them? Or do you just want to spend the least amount as possible just to go? So I'd be suggesting probably better to just get the advice about getting the proper notice and what has to be in the notice to give the warning. Because the owner might turn up a week later, 2 weeks later. They might see the notice and then they might just move it because they don't want to lose it.
Yep.
And they'll probably abandon it somewhere else. But at least it's off your land.
Yep.
But you're not allowed to just say, oh, it shouldn't be here, I'm moving it off.
Right.
Because potentially the owner could come back and say, oh, I thought that was public area and you've now damaged my car. You've destroyed the gearbox by forcibly towing it, and...
And he's right that he could very easily come back and say, oh, it was worth a lot of money, it was worth $2,000, but it was only a $200 bomb.
Yes. Well, and this is what you don't know.
Yeah.
And you don't know what's in the vehicle, and you don't know... Yeah, so these, in terms of a practical thing, I would probably be going down the stick a notice on it, wait the required time, but there are quite detailed... provisions in the road rules about these things and about abandoned property, because you know it's not yours. You can't just treat it as like, you know, finders keepers, right? That's not the law. Finders keepers is not the law. And there's actually a famous case where somebody found, you know, AFL players' medical records on the street after
I remember that.
Remember that?
Yeah.
And so there's a law called theft by finding. Because they grabbed those records, medical records of an AFL player, and then tried to sell them to the media, they got charged, those people, with theft by finding. Because when you find something and you know it's not yours, and then you work out it actually belongs to someone, you can't use it as if it's your own property. It's not your property.
It's a pretty rad act to go and stick a couple of cars on someone else's property, isn't it?
Yeah, that is. It is very sad and disappointing. And then you're stuck with them there for this minimum time that you put the notice on, before you're then allowed to tow them away. So, but you're still paying the cost of that. Until you know who the owner is, you don't know who to sue.
And you might never.
But finding out who the owner is might cost you as much as just getting it towed away.
Yeah.
So you might as well...
But you wouldn't necessarily tow it away, would you? You'd tow it out on the street.
Probably. And then you tell the council. So you answered your own question right at the beginning there.
Right. Now, just quickly... the other thing too, that with there's been a number of builders go broke over the last few months, unfortunately. But the question was that very often you can buy these apartments, particularly apartments off the plan, where you go in, you pay a deposit now, it's not going to be available 4 to 5 years, so you paid your deposit, 5 years later you go back. Two things: what happens if the builder goes broke? And secondly, you look at a plan and you think, oh yeah, that's going to really be good for me, but then you get there and you find it's like a shoebox. It's, you know, because we can't all visualise how big things are. We might look at it and say, oh yeah, that's 20 metres, and when you get there it doesn't look like it. What comeback have you got? First of all, if the builder goes broke, because have you just lost your deposit? Because there's nothing there. They're only just, you know, still selling off the plan. And what happens if it doesn't live up to your expectations off the plan?
So it's going to depend exactly on what's in your contract. And I have to generalise here, and I'd have to get specific details from our property team. But generally speaking, the deposits are held like on trust. So they shouldn't go into the liquidator's account if they're properly segregated and held as deposits for that purpose. And I think they're usually 5% deposits. So normally when you buy, you pay a 10% deposit, but on and off the plan, it's a 5% deposit. Now, they also have sunset clauses in those contracts usually, and it's usually sort of 2 years. I'm not aware. It could be long, 2 or 3. I don't think it's as long as 5.
Right.
But there were some cases a few years back which led to some changes in the law around this, where developers were they were selling all these units off the plan, but then property prices skyrocketed.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to stick with the old prices.
Oh, Grant and I discussed that.
Yeah, so they just waited for the 2 years to go by. They didn't get the plan of subdivision registered within the 2 years. And the contracts all said if the plan's not registered within 2 years, all contracts are cancelled.
Yep.
So everyone just got their deposit back, no interest, just the exact same money you put in 2 years ago.
Yep.
But the reason they did that, they cancelled all the contracts, because they sold them all again for much bigger prices. But you've been planning to move for the last 2 years, and you were waiting for your place to be built, and all you get back is your deposit. So they've made some changes to the law, I think, to make it stricter for the developers to actually be active in...
Because the alternative that if the prices of the property dropped,
yes,
then they got them through really quick.
Yeah,
you still had to pay.
Correct.
All right. We haven't just very quickly. What happens if it doesn't live up to your expectations inside?
So there are usually within these contracts there are provisions that say that there can be a certain amount of variations that they either do or do not have to notify you about, because oftentimes they're submitting plans to council, going through their architects and planners, and sometimes they'll be told, you've got to move this slightly, you've got to move that slightly, and it may change, you know, you think you're buying, you know, 50 square metre small apartment. They're allowed to change it up to 5% and you still have to go through with the contract. But more than that, they have to do a formal process of notifying you of the change, and you can get out of the contract if they're going to change it. I had an unfortunate case a few years back where a lady bought a 40 square metre apartment off the plan. And her bank gave her a pre-approval to buy that apartment. So she, that's, so she committed, she paid her deposit, she waited till they built it. But after, when it came time, the developer said, okay, it's built, it's ready, it's time for you to pay your money. So she went to the bank and said, okay, give me my loan that you pre-approved me on for the purchase of this apartment. The bank sent somebody out to measure it up, and it came in at 36 square metres. And the bank said, we don't lend on anything less than 40 square metres. And so now 4 square metres is 10% of 40. Therefore, the developer had done the wrong thing. So we took the case to get the deposit back. The developer was refusing to give the deposit back, even though they'd made this 10% change. And at the end of the day, given the values involved, the client just settled. They split the money in half because the cost of going to court to get the other half was going to be more than that. So a very disappointing case for the lady who had waited years years to...
So did the bank still settle or they...
No, the bank refused to give her the loan because the property was 36 square metres, too small for their lending criteria, even though she bought off the plan and a plan that said 40 square metres. So this is the traps you can get into with off-the-plan purchases.
Just got to take a quick break and we'll be back with more.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to the Legal Hour, and we have people from Hutchinson Legal with us to discuss all things about the law. Now, I have with me Simran. How are you, Simran?
I'm good, Alan. How are you?
And they tell me that, that you're involved with wills.
Yes.
All right, so one quick question before you talk about why we should have an executor. So you go out and you pick an executor, and you're going to tell me, you're going to tell us why we need an executor. But before that, say we pick out, well, I don't want to do it that way. So, all right, so Con's writing a will, and he thinks I'm an honest guy. I fooled him. So he just says, right, Alan, I want you as an executor. So we go away, and the life goes on, and then Con passes away, and they come to find the executor, and I'm already dead. So what do you do if the executive pick goes and dies first?
So, Con should have appointed a substitute executor in that case. And if he hasn't done that, then whoever has the biggest interest in his estate needs to apply to the court to be appointed as an administrator.
All right, so you're going to tell us about why we need an executor, but very often people do, from what I've heard, just appoint people within the family.
Yes, most people do not understand the importance of appointing a right executor. So they do appoint someone from the family, their siblings or maybe their children. But the thing to be mindful of is whether your children do get along well, whether there'll be fights later if they don't. So those things are to be, they need to keep in mind if whether they will get along well or not. It's an important role and a lot of responsibility, and you need to make the choice wisely. Somebody who's reliable and somebody you can trust.
Because, as you say, very often it is just a family member, isn't it?
It may be a family member, but you can also appoint an independent person. As I said, somebody you trust can be a friend as well.
Yeah. All right. So if you were writing a will today, who would you pick as an executor?
If you ask me, I think I would pick my husband as my executor. So most cases, the spouses appoint each other as the executor in the first instance, and then as a substitute, they appoint other people whom they'd rely or trust.
All right. So tell me how important it is to get the right executor.
It's extremely important. A lot of thought should go into deciding who your executor is, because it's a role with a lot of responsibilities. Starting with the funeral of the person when the person dies. Many cases there are no family available to do the funeral. Then the executor has to step in.
All right, so you've appointed the executor, and we'll say it's Con. I don't want to keep picking on Con. But your children say, Con says, well, this is what the funeral's going to be. And your children say, no, we don't want it that way. Who gets to say?
So I think that the executor steps in when there's no children involved. Obviously, it's a matter which the family will have the primacy.
But does the executor make the final decision, even if there's disagreement with the children? Have they got the right to overrule the children?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to know. Does the executive overrule the children and decide the funeral, or how does that work?
So I'm sure there's this something that the will maker would have written in the will regarding his burial rights, what the wishes and the cremation. So we'll go by the will, and the executor follows the will.
Right.
So that's the duty of the executor.
One of the things we should say, and I know this doesn't involve the legal side, and because I've had a funeral director in here a couple of times talking to him, you shouldn't put the details of your will. If you do the details in the will about what you want in the funeral, you should also leave other documentation, because he was telling me that very often they'll read the will a week later and the person's been buried and they had to be cremated.
That's correct.
Still, they've been cremated and they should have been buried.
That's correct. That's absolutely right.
Mm. All right, let's take a quick break. We've got a couple of other questions to come up.
Local events. Yarra Valley FM 99.1, the voice of the valley.
You're listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Con, it's taken us a while to get through some of these questions because we had a number of questions from last time. One of the things that we did have a question about was dismissing an employee. So a person comes along, I've got a job, I interview them, I won't pick on you this time, and I decide I'm going to employ a person. I offer them the job, they haven't taken the job up, but I've given them a letter of offer, they've accepted it. All of a sudden I'm out somewhere and said, are you employing such and such? I say, oh yeah, good. He or she's a pedophile. Where do I stand? Do I have to still continue on with that? I haven't asked them, are they a pedophile?
Mm. So the question, well, it always a nice lawyer answer is, depends. What's the job? Is it a truck driver? Is it a childcare worker?
Right, yeah.
Because it depends. The answer to the question depends on that. So if it's a truck driver that has no interaction with children, does it matter? To fulfilling the job? Can you drive a truck? Do you have a heavy endorsed license?
Yeah.
You've offered the job, they've accepted the job. That if you dismiss that person, they'd have rights against you for discriminating against them. Yes.
Even though...
And how long ago were they convicted of this crime?
Yeah.
And that matters too, because there's a thing called spent convictions.
Yeah. Well, that and, used to be up until a couple of years
ago. Yeah, right. That's right. And so apart from some very serious ones, now it may or may not. So when somebody describes someone else as a pedophile, you don't know exactly what the crime that they were convicted of is and whether it's a spent conviction or not a spent conviction.
Right.
Because it depends on the actual legal definition of that crime as to... And yes, you are committing an act of discrimination by cancelling their job offer because they've accepted. You formed the contract with that person, so they could sue you for their loss of income and for the discrimination because you've relied on an, you know, it's a irrelevant ground. But it does depend. We would often recommend that you should be asking for consent to do a police check.
Yeah.
But a police check wouldn't bring it up if it was more than 10 years ago, depending on the category of the offence.
Yeah. And the other thing too, like if it was a childcare worker, then you've got to get a work with children.
Correct.
And you're very unlikely to get that.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's a truck driver, you're not going to ask for that work.
Well, that's right. In that industry of childcare, you've got a duty to screen and vet everyone who comes in. So you'd be in a huge amount of trouble employing that person.
Yep.
So you can justify... not going through. But you haven't done your job very well if you didn't work that out sooner.
I'm just going to ask you this off the spur of the moment. I hope you'll know. So what right, like, I'm involved with a number of groups and I have to have police checks every time I get involved. And that's okay. I don't have a problem with that. What right would I have? So let's go back a stage. I'm interviewing this truck driver, not a childcare worker. Have I got the right to demand from him working with children, even though it's got nothing to do with children? I wouldn't have, would I?
I don't believe so. There's a thing called inherent requirements for a job, right. and you can discriminate if there is a proper inherent requirement and they can't fulfil it. So going back to the truck driver, do you have a heavy endorsed license? Well, if you don't, I don't have to employ you. I can discriminate on that basis.
Yep.
But so with the police check, with the working with children check, again, the employer can say, well, how's that relevant to the job you're asking me to do?
Yep.
They can say either I don't have one or I don't need to, even if I had one, I don't need to give it to you. It's completely irrelevant to the job you advertised and that I'm interviewing for. So, you need to be careful with that. But, of course, if it is relevant, and a lot of volunteer organisations will demand both, you might be a volunteer at some soccer club or a sporting club, I'm a religious group. And they're going to ask for both. We want your consent for a police check and we want your working with children check because you deal with children, you come across children.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
And so it should be. So that's the way. But if you've got a completely different job that's no contact with children whatsoever, it's none of your business to be asking those questions.
Righto, let's take another quick break.
Is now broadcasting from new studio facilities at 9 Lilydale Road, Healesville.
Sound so true, it almost startles you.
Feel free to get in touch via email info@yarravalleyfm.org.au. Call us on 59615991.
It's only the beginning.
Reception so clear, performance so great, you'll wonder what you've been missing.
Yarra Valley FM 99.1, the voice of the valley.
always.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice.
Yes, you like.
Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to the Legal Hour, and we're talking to Con and Simran. Con, we missed one spot on the
car. Yes, there was some another tip for the cars. It's always, you should do what's called a PPSR search, which is a personal property security register search. You can search it, you've got to search it by the VIN number, and it will tell you whether, like a finance company has an interest in the car, and that might be another way of not finding out who the owner is through the finance company.
When you're talking about it, let me just chuck one other quick question at you. What about if it's got a personal loan? Because that's not necessarily against the car, is it?
Well, it's only if they've secured the loan against the car. If they haven't, you won't find it on the PPSR. But any dealings with cars, when you're buying, selling, anything, you should always do a PPSR search. It's like $2, $3, very cheap, very quick, and it'll tell you about the vehicle and if anyone's got a security interest in it.
Con, bankruptcy, you want to tell us that it's going to get harder and harder to get your money back if someone goes broke?
Well, yes, the Federal Attorney General has invited submissions because they're proposing to change some bankruptcy laws. And at the moment, if you've got a judgment debt against somebody, somebody owes you money and you've sued them and the court says, yes, they should pay you, at the moment, your debt has to be more than $10,000, and then you can apply to make them bankrupt.
Right.
After following a process with a bankruptcy notice and a creditor's petition, you can force them to become bankrupt for not paying your debt. The government's considering increasing that threshold to $20,000 permanently. It was $20,000 during the pandemic because they didn't want people running around bankrupting others during the pandemic. But they're now looking to increase that permanently. This change could come through in the first 6 months next year after this consultation happens. And so the reason I mention this is it's so hard to collect debts through the court system and through the civil enforcement procedures, like sending a sheriff around or trying to get it out of their wages or things like that. Those procedures are difficult enough, but if you've got a debt now that's between $10,000 and $20,000, and you're thinking about, I'm going to have to bankrupt that person, you better do it before they change the law, because you'll then be left with the other lesser methods of trying to force them to pay your debt. There's one more change.
Yep.
That they're looking at just extending the time to respond to a bankruptcy notice. So that's usually the first step in the procedure.
Yep.
And making it from 21 days to 28 days. The importance is a lot of bankruptcy notices will have a flaw in them and can be challenged. But if you don't know your rights, if you don't go and ask a lawyer that understands bankruptcy, you won't know that, and you could end up bankrupt on an invalid bankruptcy notice. So it's important that they're increasing that time frame so a person can get advice and try and knock out the bankruptcy notice, because the court applies it very strictly. Bankruptcy is a very serious thing.
Yep. All right, we've got to take our last break, and then we'll be back with more.
When you were young and your heart wasn't old. This ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give in and cry. Say, live and let die. Live and let die. We'll be right back.
listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections and Legal AR. All right, we've had a number of questions, so I think the best way to do, rather than ask you a whole pile of questions, right, there's changes coming up to the bail. It's been, I believe it's been read in the lower house, or it's been to the upper house, and it's going to come back. These are where we're talking about not only bail, we're talking about children not being able to be charged. Now, there's been two or three in the last probably few weeks where children have been involved in really, really serious crimes as young as 13. So I guess probably rather than just ask you question after question, could you have someone have a look at what the changes to the bail and this whole thing are going to be? Just a quick pricey. What happens if a 13-year-old gets charged with murder? Do they still get off, or is it just said, well, you know, you're too young? Or are there exemptions there that say, well, if you're 13, but it's this category of charges, you can still be charged. Same thing with 14. I believe 14 and under you can't be charged. I don't know. And so we've had a number of questions. I've even had two this morning where people rang and said, we don't know what these charges are. They look like they're going to come in. Can we find out what they are? Because there's been some fairly young people being involved in some pretty horrendous stuff in the last few weeks. So,
all right, we'll take that on notice because there's a lot to it.
There's a bit to it, isn't there? Simran, let's go back to talking about the executor. I guess you're saying to us that you really have to have an executor. I'm just going to throw a quick one past you and then you can tell us a bit more about it. But you've got an executor, you're young people, you ask this person, will they be the executor? And they say, yep, we're happy with that. And then 40 years later, 50 years later, you die and the estate goes to the executor and he says, nah, I'm too old now, I don't want to do it. So where do you go there?
So first of all, the person who's made a will, he shouldn't wait for 40, 50 years, should keep checking with the executor.
It doesn't happen.
whether he's still willing to take on the role of an executor. Yep. And if that happens, what you say, after 40, 50 years and nobody checked and he doesn't want to do it any longer, then he has the option to renounce probate. So he applies to the Supreme Court saying, you know, applying for renunciation of probate, and then the person who has the biggest interest in the estate can apply to be an administrator.
So that in the case of a family, that's probably going to be one of the children, isn't it?
Yes, so most likely it'll be one of the children or, you know, whoever is interested obviously has the largest stake. Yeah.
All right. So we'll say you've got two children and so you've made them joint executors because that's how you want. We'll say, yeah. So, all right, they can't agree. One says, this is how Dad's will is, or Mum's will, and the other one says, no, I don't agree with that interpretation. How do you go?
So that's the problem when we are making the will. We do ask the will maker whether they anticipate any kind of a dispute and whether their children get along well and they want to appoint them as joint executors, because that's the problem we are seeing these days, lots of disputes between the executors.
Yep. I can understand that but then the trouble is when they do the will today, everybody's fine. Everyone's happy, and then something happens in the family down the track and those two siblings fall out. I mean, that can happen too.
Yes, so then they have to apply to the court, and maybe the court will then in that case appoint an independent administrator.
Yeah, because would the court be more entitled to pick one of those children, or are they more likely to say neither, we're going to appoint a third person?
So it depends. The court will see if there has been a joint appointment, or you know what they say, why they don't want to be an executor or they want to be, and decide on the basis of that. Or if the court sees that doesn't look like they'll be able to work together, might appoint an independent administrator, and that's what in most cases is happening these days.
So there are a number of cases where this is happening, are they?
Yeah, that's what we see day in, day out, that, you know, the court is appointing an independent administrator. Any, you know, lawyers or solicitors are appointed as independent administrator in these cases.
Are they? So, it's not someone like estate trustees or something. It's more like to be their local lawyer or something that's appointed as the executor?
Yes, that's a choice that the court makes, yes.
Yeah, but more likely to be a lawyer, though, than a big company?
That's what I have seen in most cases. Somebody who's renowned in this area of law and has a lot of experience is appointed as an independent administrator.
I'm going to throw a question at you. I know the answer you're going to come up with, because there are so many of these self-made will kits floating around that a lot of people are using them, but they're very inherent with danger, aren't they? Because while it's very, you need to have everything very, very specific, don't you, rather than just fairly open-ended.
Yes, so these kits are very cheap, but then they don't do the job of a lawyer, or, you know, do not give the advice that is required. So there are very, very many complications and lots of other things that need to be taken care of, which the software or the will kits or whatever is online, doesn't take care of.
Yeah. I just wanted to add in there that you can use a will kit successfully, but I always say you don't do your own dental work, you shouldn't do your own legal work.
That's a good point.
And so you can, if everything's very simple, you can use a simple will kit, but it has to be very simple. As soon as there's some complication, something out of the very basic, you know, there's just one house and one bank account.
Yep.
If it's beyond that, I don't think a will kit's really suitable.
Yep.
And, of course, there's the famous case of Peter Brock, the race car driver, who had four of his own do-it-yourself wills, and they spent millions in court fighting over which one was the right one because he kept changing his mind. So, look, will kits, lawyers are going to say use a lawyer, but if you don't, will kits create work for lawyers later on. So,
and the other thing is too, pardon me, is that when you're talking about estates, I mean the average house now is 800 to 1.2 million. So it's not like you're talking about a $20,000 thing. If it goes bad, you can be talking $500,000 to $1 million, can't you?
Yes, that's correct. A lot of money or estate is at stake, and so much of the assets that people own these days sometimes doesn't even fall part of the will. So a holistic estate plan is required, and not just a will, because superannuation is a big part of people's assets, which doesn't form part of the will.
And the other thing to keep in mind is accountants will set people up with discretionary family trusts, and there'll be a property that's in the trust, and people will put that property in their will. But that will is not part of... I mean, so that property is not part of the will maker's personal estate.
Oh, right, yeah.
But they think it's theirs because they use it.
Yeah.
But the accountant set them up in a structure that means it's not theirs. So they think they're giving it away in their will to their children, but it's completely controlled by the trust and the trust deed and whoever's the trustee of that trust. So it's outside the will altogether. So you need to be very careful about what is in the will, what is not in the will. And that's the problem with these will kits as well. Who's telling you where your assets are and which ones do you have the right to deal with in your will? And when it comes to super, you have to do what's called a binding death benefit nomination if you really want to control where it goes.
Right.
And that's like, it's called the will for your super. So you need a will for your will for your stuff and a will for your super. They're two different documents, so very important. And then the trusts, the whole arrangement of trusts and structures is very important to understand.
From what I've heard, a lot of people use trusts, don't they?
Yeah.
Yes, so the assets that are held these days, there's a lot of complexity involved because lots of assets are held in trust, and also, through a will you can do a testamentary trust, which has lots of benefits as well. So it's a little complex than your standard will, a bit expensive as well. But then there are twin benefits of asset protection and tax savings for if you do a testamentary trust.
And that's why they're put in there, aren't they? Like, these trusts don't exist for any other reason than either to protect the asset or for a tax purpose, because that's what trusts are for, aren't they?
Yeah. It doesn't make it improper, but yeah. it's there, can be done, but it has to be done properly and understood by the people involved.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. Look, and the other thing too, and I know, and I just alluded to this earlier, that, you know, if you've got other things that are going to come into play, like your funeral and that, you need to make sure that's in other places in the world, because not everybody wants to run to the lawyer the 2 days after mum or dad have died and found out what it is, and they read the will later, and it's, you know, it's all over. Look, it's unfortunately I've got to go. The news and weather are right here, and thank you for the two of you, Con and Simran, for coming in.
Thank you, Alan, for inviting us.
Yeah, great to be here.
Thanks.